My name is June. I'm an alcoholic. If you'd listened to the tape, you would have gotten that name straight. I'm grateful that Lynn didn't listen to the tape, because at least I'll feel like there's one person out there who hasn't already heard me. I want to welcome any of you who are new, and I know there were a number of you last night who raised your hand, who are at your first conference or are relatively new to Alcoholics Anonymous. The most important thing I can tell you is very much like what they just read about the opinion thing. Anything I say up here is my own opinion on things that I have learned here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not an expert on Alcoholics Anonymous or on AA or on anything else that I can think of right now, and I think that's really important that you know that, that I'm just another member that's going to stand up here for a while. And it's also very important to me, if you are new or maybe visiting, that you know that I'm not paid to get up here and talk. And that's important to me because Alcoholics Anonymous was free when I came here. It has always been free. Had it not been free when I came, I never could have come. And had it not remained free, I never could have stayed. And I know that I used to think that they paid the people to get up here. It's also important that you know that, because then afterwards, you know, I could just see you standing around saying, they had to pay her for that, you know. So I'm delighted to be here. I've had a fantastic weekend hearing all the same people that you've heard share, many of whom are, they're all really special in my life in a variety of different ways. You know, it's funny, in Alcoholics Anonymous, there are some people who touch our lives or have touched mine, and I just remember little stories that they share, and I don't remember anything else, you know, and it takes me, sometimes somebody will say, have you heard, you know, Yvonne or someone, and I'll say, I don't know, but then as soon as I heard about her dogs mating and then her getting married 3 months later, I knew I'd heard her, you know, and that's just kind of the way I am. You may think that means I'm not that spiritual, because those are the things, you know, I don't remember, you know, Yvonne's explanation of the third step or things like that, but I really am, I'm there and I pay attention, I'm able to kind of catch on, and it really works that way. I'm very much a story person in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm so delighted that you invited me to be part of your conference, and so that I can meet and make a few new friends, which has always happened for me at conferences, and so that I've had the privilege of spending time with some of the very special ones that you've invited here to be part of your conference and share with you. You know, in thinking about stories, there's one woman back home from where I am that has told a number of stories that have just meant so much in my life. One of the things that Julie shares about is when she was pretty new, she was standing on this corner and she was waiting for a bus. And she had to get this bus because she had to get home, because she had to make dinner so that her husband wouldn't get mad when she went to the meeting that night. Because he was one of those people that had to have his dinner on the table, you know, exactly at the right time. And so she was standing there waiting for the bus, and she was new, and the bus wasn't coming. And where's the bus? And she's looking around, and there's no bus, and I got to get the bus, I've got to get home, I got to get dinner ready so I can get to the meeting, and where is the bus? And then she started to stand there, started to pray for a bus, you know, and the bus didn't come. And then it started to rain, and she started to cry, you know. And then she thought, I've got to drink, which makes sense. You know, the bus didn't come, I should drink, you know. I mean, you know how that is. It's just A follows B. And she was thinking, you know, I should drink. I thought, maybe I should wait for the bus because I really, you know. And she was standing there, and suddenly this woman drove up in her Mercedes and rolled down her little electric window and said, hi. She said, don't you go to the Tuesday night meeting or whatever? And Julie said, yes. And she said, you know, where are you headed? And the woman was heading that same direction. And so Julie got in, and the woman gave her a ride. And Julie later realized when she was home making dinner that she'd gotten home 10 or 15 minutes earlier than she would have if she'd got the bus that was scheduled to arrive by the time, you know, she would have made the difference of walking home. And she said later on in her sobriety, she would think about that, and she'd think, there I was standing there praying for a bus when God sent me a Mercedes. And a lot of times when my life seems to be, you know, one where I'm standing there praying for a bus in its varied shapes and forms, depending on what the situation is, I think, well, maybe there's a Mercedes coming around, and it just kind of helps me laugh. I don't want you to think my life's been filled with Mercedes since I came into AA, but, you know, it's been an attitude kind of a thing that's really worked for me. And I thought, you know, I was about a month ago, I was at a wonderful conference, or maybe 2 months ago, and Ken was there, and I just had a wonderful time in Florida. And the last time I had been in Florida, I had had the privilege of getting to spend a couple of days with a man named John Vicar, who passed away fairly recently. And some of you might know him as John the Indian. And he was just the most wonderful, special, sweet man. And I got to spend a couple days just kind of hanging around. And one of the stories that John told at that conference, I was sober almost 10 years when he told this story. And when I heard it, I don't know, he may have told it many times before, but when he told it that weekend, was he said when he was new, he was living in a mission. And his sponsor was a guy who he had known from the mission. And John, and for those of you who don't know him, I mean, it's like when the mission for him was kind of like being a high bottom drunk at that point, you know, because he'd been on the streets the rest of the time. And so he was really, things were kind of looking up. And when he was living in this mission, he'd known his sponsor from this mission before, but his sponsor by this time had been sober a little while and lived somewhere else and was married. And so John said his sponsor would pick him up at the mission to take him to meetings. And on the way to the meeting, he always had a sack lunch. And he would say, his sponsor would say to John, he'd say, John, listen, I really need you to help me out here. I got this lunch, and what it is my wife made me a sandwich for dinner because she knew I didn't have much time to eat on my way to the meeting. And if you could just eat half of it with me, it would really help me out so that she won't be mad at me and think I don't care about her sandwich when I get home. And John said he was many years sober before he ever realized that this guy ate dinner with his wife every night. But he knew that if he offered John the whole sandwich, that John was too proud and he wouldn't take it. So he just asked him to share and eat half of his sandwich. And so many things like that have happened for me in my sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous, things that I don't even recognize until 5, 10, 15 years down the road when I look back and I realize the way that someone did things or the things that Vinoy was sharing, you know, where you're kind of standing there and you don't even know how you're going to get home from the meeting and you find a $5 bill in your purse and you know you didn't have that $5 bill there. And someone just put it in there because they knew that you were having a hard time, but you were really trying. And it wasn't like AA was supporting you, not in that financial sense that our book says that's not what we're here to do, but it was just one member kind of being there for another one at the right time. There's so many things like that. My sponsor used to tell this story about when she was new, and I try and remember this one. My sponsor said she was about 30 days sober or so, and she had a cat. And she loved this cat more than anything else in the whole world. This was her drinking cat. And her and her cat used to sit on the mantle and drink. She would drink, but the cat would sit there and with, you know. And when she got sober, and she was fairly newly sober, one day she looked and she saw that her cat had fleas. And she became absolutely hysterical. And she called one of the members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she was hysterical. And she says, Muffy, or whatever the hell its name was, you know, Muffy has fleas, Muffy has fleas, you know. And she said this member of Alcoholics Anonymous came over and gave her cat a flea bath. And she said, you know, if he had said to me at that time, what step are you working? She said, you know, it wouldn't have helped. But he came over and he gave her cat a flea bath. And so sometimes, you know, when I'm standing there and I think I know the answer for someone or I want to just say, you know, say a certain thing, sometimes it's really as simple as just giving some flea shampoo and giving their cat a flea bath. And I've had a lot of people that have given me a few flea baths. when I got sober, I needed some of those. I talked at a meeting probably 5 or 8 years ago now, and after the meeting, this guy came up to thank me mostly because his sponsor made him. I was the bigger guy, you know, standing in back of him, kind of pushing him up there. And he shook my hand and he said, thank you. He said, I thought that was a very good story. He said, I don't believe it was your story, but I like the way you told it. And I thought, you know, it's only in Alcoholics Anonymous that we could be so paranoid as to think that people are making up, you know, stories to come in here. And then I thought, you know, if he'd seen me when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, he would have known that it really was my story. Because I looked like my story when I got sober. You know, most of us do, I guess, except for the Al-Anons. They usually look worse, you know. They didn't get to drink through it. I am one of those people who believes I was born an alcoholic. I don't want to have a philosophical discussion with any of you about that after the meeting. Simply something I believe. And I believe it because it's comfortable for me. And I believe it because there was something very, very wrong with me long before alcohol ever was entered into my system. I grew up in an alcoholic home. I knew about alcoholism firsthand, the way I know many of you did. And in my home, there was a lot of broken promises. There was a lot of violence. There was a lot of all the same things that go on in anybody else's alcoholic home, you know. And I knew that I wasn't going to be like that, that my life wasn't going to be like that. But, you know, before even realizing all of those kind of things, I certainly didn't recognize it as alcoholism. I knew that there was something wrong with me. From the earliest memories that I have ever had, I never liked anything about myself. You've heard a number of people share this weekend about the fact that through their drinking or their Al-Anonism, that they found themselves going from here to here and slowly giving up their self-worth and their dignity and their good values and compromising their own beliefs. And that isn't quite my story, because I don't remember ever having any values or beliefs or dignity or anything else. I never liked anything about myself from as far back as I can remember, which seems to be about 5. I can remember standing in the mirror at 5, and I hated absolutely everything about myself. I hated having curly red hair. I hated being tall. I hated being skinny. I hated living where I lived. I hated the family that I was living in. I hated everyone that was around me. I hated the school that I had to go to. And most of all, I always, always hated the way that I felt. It always hurt too much for me. Always. And thank God that I was introduced to drugs and alcohol when I was, because I honestly believe I'm one of those people that would have had to have been locked inside of an institution, because I couldn't make it out there. And I realize that that's not everyone's story, that a lot of you had a lot of fun social drinking, but that was not the case with me. I've never had a social drink in my life, nor have I ever really wanted one. It just doesn't seem to make much sense to me. I've never had one pill in my life. I overdosed from the very first, and I thought that was great, and I never stopped that. You know, And from the time that I was about 5, I started to try and kill myself. And at that age, I started to cut my hands and fingers and wrists with razor blades and take overdoses of baby aspirin, which was all I knew about at the time. I used to beat my face and body with hammers, and I used to, when my mom left me in the car while she was in the bar drinking, I would take the cigarette lighter and burn myself on as many places on my body as I could. And that is just the way that I always was, you know. And I didn't expect it to get any better than that. And I didn't really want to hang around to see whether it would or not. I just wanted out. Now, when I found alcohol and the chemicals that I found, they didn't make me feel better. They didn't even make me, feel like everything was okay. That wasn't how I drank or why. They made me not care. They made it all go away. They made me not feel anything at all, and that's what I needed them for, and that's how I used them. I wanted to die. It was my number one request. And obviously, as you look at me today, you can see that I wasn't very successful at it. And I had to somewhere along the line accept the fact that I wasn't able to kill myself or what somehow it hadn't worked yet. But I continued to try. I don't think there were any days before I got sober that I didn't try and take my life, put myself in a position where someone else would take my life, or pray to a God that I was slowly losing faith in to please let me die. I just wanted out. And it was always that way for me. And the only piece, if you want to call it that, it's the closest word I can think of that would seem to work, that I ever had, was when I was under the influence of alcohol or in the state of some form of overdose on my way there or on my way back out, you know, and that was it. Now, if you drank the way that I did and you mixed it with the kind of chemicals that I did, then you don't have a very exciting drunkalog either, because when you mix alcohol with the kind of pills that I did, you can't do much either. And I didn't. I've done a lot of throwing up, a lot of overdosing, and that's pretty much about what I did before I came to AA. Now, in growing up, I was kind of an observer of people. I know today a lot of the people I was observing were alcoholics, that were my mom's drinking buddies, and I never remember seeing a man cry until after I got sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, under any circumstances. I saw men shot, stabbed, beaten, arrested, have their parents die, have their kids die, have their wives leave them, all the different situations that happen in life, and none of them ever cried under any of those circumstances. Now, I saw women go through those same circumstances in my life, and a lot of them didn't cry either, but many of them did. And I looked at those two different groups of people, and I decided immediately which one I wanted to be like. And I spent my whole life trying to be what I thought a man was. And to me, a man was someone who cared about no one, who felt absolutely nothing, and if they did, never let anyone know it. And that was how I tried to live my life. The only acceptable emotion that I saw men seeming to think was acceptable, and the only emotion I believed was acceptable, was anger and rage. That was okay. But other than that, there were no emotional reactions that were acceptable. Now, without alcohol, I seemed to be on a, you know, an emotional roller coaster constantly. Kind of like Clancy will talk about, you know, the fact that he was one of those people that was born without any insulation for his emotions. And that was definitely true of me. From the age of 5, when I remember getting out there in the world and going to school, you know, and I'd walk on that school campus and those kids would start to tease me about, you know, having curly red hair or being tall or being skinny or whatever it was, the way I dressed, whatever it was. I mean, it would feel like I was being cut up inside with knives. You know, and in the early days of my sobriety, when I used to think it was important, I used to remember who they were, what they were wearing, what their names were, you know. And, I mean, it's the funniest thing. I don't remember one teacher that was ever nice to me. And I had lots of teachers that were nice, you know, but I remember all the people and what they teased me about and what the names were and all that, you know. But anyway, and it just kind of tore me up inside. And here were these people that were absolute strangers. I didn't even care about them. And they could just cut me to ribbons inside by calling me names. And that was nothing compared to the people that I did care about, what they could do, with, you know, to me. And so I made it a point learning that about myself. First of all, I found that alcohol helped me be sure that no one could ever hurt me, that I didn't care. No one mattered, including me, as long as I had alcohol. And then I also made it a point to be sure that people were much more likely to punch me in the face than they were to ever hit me emotionally in any kind of a way. And so I tried to live my life on as far from any kind of an emotional level as I could. In growing up where I did, in seeing what I saw as far as men not feeling anything, I decided that I wanted to be a boy when I grew up. And that's when people would say, you know, what do you want to be? And they thought I'd say a nurse or a teacher. Like, I want to be a boy. And it wasn't as easy back then as it is today. Very much upset my family and my mother. And they began taking me to priests. I'm also from an Irish Catholic family. They began taking me to priests. And then my mom found out, because we were on welfare, that we could go to psychiatrists and psychologists, and they began to take me to psychiatrists and psychologists, where I started getting prescriptions for the medication that I could overdose with. And they wanted to, you know, to talk. Now, I don't have any kind of diagnoses to give you about what those people thought was wrong with me, why I kept trying to kill myself, or why I hated myself the way that I did, or why I was trying to control my emotions, or anything else, because I always felt that psychiatrists and psychologists, like my friend Patty Hicks always said, should have to work for their money, and I never told them anything. I never answered one question. I never filled out one form. I sat there the required period of time, and then I got up, and I left. I wanted nothing to do with those people. Anyway, I kind of just wandered out in the world and somehow accepted the fact that I could not be a boy. And the way I saw the world, if I couldn't be a boy, then that left just one thing. I had to be a tough broad. And that's what I spent all my time trying to do before I came in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and a long time afterward, was trying to be a tough broad. Now, I've learned, you know, in traveling around Alcoholics Anonymous, that being a tough broad does vary geographically. There's geographical standards. You know, there are some, first of all, there are makeup-wearing tough broads. Now, I was a non-makeup-wearing tough broad. Because there wasn't any way throughout my life I was ever going to look at my face long enough to put makeup on it. So that was just out of the question. I grew up in a beach town. It's called Venice out in Los Angeles. And in a beach town, it's very important if you're a tough broad that you never wear shoes. And so I didn't. It was important if you're a tough broad that you do a lot of fighting. And so I did. I was in a gang. And I think it's important that I let you know that I've never won a fight. But I've never fought less than 5 people at a time. And my sponsor explained to me after I got sober that the reason I always fought 5 or more was if you fight one person and you lose, someone might think you're not a very good fighter. But if you always fight groups of 5 or more, then nobody expects you to win. And they think, God, she must be pretty tough, or why would that many people have to jump her? So I would walk around with my face beat in a lot. And some people, I guess, thought that I was tough. You know, I, of course, never convinced the most important person, being myself. But in the years that I've been sober, I've been kind of grateful that tattoos were not as popular on the streets when I was out there as they have become. I have a lot of my women friends today in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous that have tattoos. Usually they have something in some kind of little discreet place, like a little butterfly or a flower, you know, or a bunny rabbit or something, you know. Tattoos have been popular when I was on the streets. I'd be standing up here today, I'd have a shark on my arm. It would swim whenever I did this. I'd have something like a battleship on my chest, or maybe a canoe in my case, but if I had thought that it would convince anyone that I was tough, there is no question in my mind as I look back that I would have done it. You know, one of my favorite things to do was walk down with my gang looking tough, and I'd see touristy-looking people, and they'd look at us. They always looked at us. And I would take my cigarette, and I would throw it down on the sidewalk, and I'd put it out with my bare feet. And these touristy-looking people would whisper back and forth, and I knew what they were saying. They were saying, wow, she is one tough broad. And I was very impressed that I could do this, and I was sure that they were far more impressed, you know, than I even was. And again, after I'd been sober a while, my sponsor explained to me that maybe what some of those people were saying to one another was, did you see that? That person just put flesh to fire. Why would anybody do anything so stupid, you know? But I thought it was tough, and I didn't think there was any other way to look at that kind of activity, you know. And then just being able to step on lit cigarette butts did not mean you were truly tough. You were only truly tough if you were then able to walk upon those feet as if it did not hurt. And those were the things that were important to me before I came to the program. I just remembered the signer here. You know, in court, they call me Greyhound because I talk so fast, and so I'm sorry. I'll try and work on that. I say that to them, too, but then I just keep on doing it, sort of like Pat. when I was out there, my mother brought me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and my mother had been in and out of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous for a long, long time by that time, with varying lengths of sobriety. She brought me to a meeting not because I asked for help, not because I wanted help, not because either one of us really thought I had a drug problem. We knew that I had some problems, but we didn't really think it was, you know, drugs or alcohol or anything. We just thought it was kind of an attitude problem, maybe. And she brought me to this meeting because she was afraid I might get her evicted from the apartment if she left me alone again. And so I walked in the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous began for me that night. And it began for me even though I didn't get sober that night. It began because there was a guy in that meeting that I admired more than anybody else in the whole world. And again, I know that a lot of you may not be able to identify with this, but it's my story, and so I got to tell it the way that it was. I admired Paul because he was from Venice. He was from my neighborhood. He was actually a drinking friend of my mother's. Paul had been in prison. He had tattoos, he carried a knife and had it with him at the meeting that night, he rode a motorcycle, and he was one of the most hostile and violent men I had ever known. And I looked at him and I thought, wow, I just never thought people this great came to AA. You know, I mean, I thought it was just for weak people like my mother. I mean, I was so impressed. If I had to tell you what I wanted out of life in one sentence when I got sober, I wanted the ability to walk into rooms full of strangers and have everyone there back away from me in terror. Now, when you're 87 pounds, that almost never happens. But it was what I wanted. And Paul was the kind of guy, I saw him walk into bars and I saw him walk into, you know, different people's houses. And if he wanted to sit at your table, you just let him. Because once Paul had been drinking, you didn't know what he was going to do. He was that mean, he was that crazy. And so I looked at this man who had achieved everything that I wanted out of life. The ability to clear rooms and tables. And he was sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it made a big impression on me. I got drunk the next night and then I came back to some meetings. And I didn't raise my hand because I wasn't an alcoholic. And even if I'd been an alcoholic, I wasn't going to join an organization that was allowing my mother to belong to it. So I went to these meetings, you know, and in between the meetings, I explained to Paul that I wasn't an alcoholic, that I couldn't possibly be an alcoholic, that I was far too young to be an alcoholic, that I had places to go, things to do, people to see. I had my whole life ahead of me. I wasn't anything like my mother, who was very alcoholic, and that I was really just not alcoholic. Now, I later found out that non-alcoholics don't have to spend any time trying to convince other people that they're not alcoholic. They already know that, you know. And Paul turned to me and he said, you know, June, I'm pretty new in this AA thing, and they tell me I can't diagnose anybody's disease but my own. He said, but in your case, I'm going to make an exception. I've seen the way that you drink, and I've seen the way that you use pills, and I happen to believe if you don't come into this program and take what these people have to offer you within a period of 6 months or less, you're going to be out on the streets, you're going to be shooting stuff, and you're going to be selling your ass. And I knew he wasn't trying to scare me. He wasn't trying to make up a story about something he knew nothing about or he'd watched some documentary about or something. He was just talking about facts. He was just talking about things that were happening in his life and things that were happening and had happened in mine. And I thought a little bit about what he said, but I did not want to be an alcoholic. I did not want to have to come into Alcoholics Anonymous. And in that 2-week period of time, as I went to meetings, absolutely every alternative but Alcoholics Anonymous was removed from my life. My mom, by the time I got sober, the only person I hated more than my mother was myself. And I hated my mother because she was an alcoholic, and I blamed her for everything that had ever gone wrong in my life, and a lot had gone wrong, you know. And it was years after I was sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous before I worked the steps and learned to take some responsibility for my own life. But at that point, I was nowhere near that. You know, it had always been very convenient to have an alcoholic parent. I'd gotten out of everything I ever had to do. You know, when I was up against the wall, I'd say, and my mother's an alcoholic, and they'd let me go. The police would let me go, and the teachers would let me go, and I, you know, whatever. I mean, you know. Anyway, it was kind of like gang warfare. I'd have this gang approach, and I'd say, my mother's an alcoholic. I'd say, all right, well, we won't beat her up today, you know. No. anyway, I just used it all through my life, and it was just wonderful because I knew I was right. But anyway, I was at this point in time, the only person I hated more than her was myself. Because of the way that I felt about my mother, I used to attack her physically. And when my mom was drinking, she really didn't do much about that. I mean, she'd try and fight back, you know, but she never really, you know, did anything else about it. But now she was sober. And she didn't think that since she was sober, she had to have someone live in her home and attack her. And she asked me to leave, and I did. The rest of my family had not spoken to me in a couple of years. I'm an only child, but I have a lot of aunts and uncles and cousins, and they would not speak to me, and I was not allowed to call or come by under any circumstances, and I hadn't been allowed to for a couple of years by that time. I had been in a lot of foster homes, I think five, maybe even six by then. I'd been thrown out of all of them. None of them would take me back. I tried to get into some drug rehab and alcohol recovery homes that were around in the LA area at that time. None of them would take me, some because of my age, some just because of my attitude. And then I thought, well, you know what? Who cares? Who cares about all these families and these, you know, foster homes and my own family and these programs? None of that really matters. If you're a tough broad, there's only one thing that counts. There's only one thing that's important, and that's your gang. And then one day as I walked down an alley, all five members of my own gang beat me up. And I found myself sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was 87 pounds. I had a black eye. I had a swollen lip. I had no money. I had no family. I had no shoes. Wouldn't have worn shoes at that time if I'd had them. I had no place to stay, and I raised my hand in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, you can see where it was kind of simple. It wasn't like, would you like to go to Hawaii or join AA, you know? It was a much easier decision than that. And when I raised my hand in meetings at that time or in that meeting, I know that that there were some people at that time that were not aware of the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, in particular the third tradition, the one that says the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Which means that no one anywhere can ever throw anyone out of a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Even if they don't like their color, their sexual preference, their financial background, their religious preference, whatever it is. And thank God that they kept it simple and just put it in. Because that, you know, they had a lot of talks about making it a little bit more structured than that. And if you ever get an opportunity to read in the 12 and 12 what they were thinking about using as the requirements for membership, you may find, as I have, that my closest friends, myself and my sponsors, would not have ever been allowed to come into Alcoholics Anonymous. Anyway, at that point, I'm sure that, that some of these people did not know about the third tradition, and I'm not saying everyone, but just some. And they came up to me after meetings and they told me I was too young to be an alcoholic because they knew how old I was from my mother. And they told me that they didn't want a little kid coming to their meetings while they talked about serious things. And they told me if I came back, they'd get together and throw me out. And I want you to know my mother would have been the first one in the pack to do so. Because to my mother, my joining Alcoholics Anonymous was the final failure to her. It meant that she had really, really failed. And it was just a horrible, horrible thing for her to deal with at that time. Anyway, I just figured at that point that Alcoholics Anonymous didn't want me either. And I didn't know that. I mean, I didn't know that there was a tradition that said that they had to keep me, whether they wanted me or not. I just thought they didn't want me, and that was okay with me, because I didn't want me either. And I had it for a long, long time. And I fell back on my number one answer. It was the answer I'd been using since I was 5 years old. And I took enough pills to kill myself one more time. And before I passed out, I found myself in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was a noon meeting. I couldn't sit. I couldn't stand. I had to lay in the meeting. And I don't know about where you guys go to meetings here in Missouri. But where I got sober in West Los Angeles, they almost never called on people to share who were laying in the meeting. For some reason that day they called on me. I really don't know what I said. They realized that I needed to be in a hospital, and that's where I woke up next. And a doctor explained to me that the pills I had taken were to slow down my heart. And had I been there 5 or 10 minutes later, I would have been in a coma that they probably couldn't have brought me out of. And I really don't know why that overdose was any different than all the other overdoses that I had taken over the years. I just know that it was. Because since that time, I haven't taken anything that affects me from the neck up. That's how I personally define sobriety. I've done that one day at a time. The 13th of July of this year, I celebrated 17 continuous years of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm the newcomer of your group of speakers thus far. Everybody's sobriety and Al-Anonism date precedes me. And so many of the people that you heard share were the old-timers when I got here. And then, of course, there were lots of others, too. But they're just very special people. The longer I'm sober, the more grateful I am, sort of like Vinoy was sharing yesterday, for the people who were here when I got here. You know, And I'm grateful because they tolerated me. And tolerate is really the only word that I think is appropriate for what needed to be done with me. You know, I've seen newcomers that are very lovable. I've seen them walk in, and I've seen people pat them on the back and kind of pass them from table to table. You know, one of my closest friends, Margie, was one of those. She cried for 2 or 3 years, you know, and people just kind of patted her around and took her to meetings, and it was just wonderful. I wasn't that kind. In fact, Margie and I became friends because I thought, somebody has to talk to this woman. You know what I mean? I mean, she is going to get killed out there showing feelings like this. And over the years, Margie's kind of taught me how to cry, and I've taught her how to be hostile. So it kind of worked out. I came into this program with a bad attitude. Now, I mentioned earlier that I had a bad attitude, so I don't want you to think I was suddenly struck with a bad attitude as far as, you know, as soon as I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. I simply came here with the only attitude I had ever had, and it had always been bad as far as I can remember. I did not like women. I didn't like any women. I didn't like me. I didn't like my mother. Figured any of these other alcoholic women around here had to be like one of the two of us, and I didn't like them. I didn't want to sit next to women. I didn't want to shake hands with women. I certainly was not going to hug women, and I did not like women speakers, which is something that always makes me feel better because I know there are never as many people listening to me as it looks like. Now, as far as men were concerned, the only men I had ever known in my life were alcoholics who beat up women, and they scared me. And I didn't want anything to do with men like that. And I figured all the alcoholic men around here had to be like that, and I didn't want anything to do with them either. Now, that was a problem, because in July of 1972, when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, all we had here were men and women. I didn't like any of them, you know. I got to this program, I did not wear shoes most of the first 2 years that I was sober. It wasn't like I took them off to go to meetings. I mean, I just didn't wear them anywhere, you know. I had a very limited vocabulary when I got sober. Consisted almost solely of profanity. There were a few exceptions, the and mother. Found a number of people in Alcoholics Anonymous who were extremely offended by my kind of language, and I tried to use it more when they were around. I smoked 3 packs of cigarettes a day when I got sober. I lit all of them myself. Occasionally someone would hold a match, and I allowed them to hold it as long as they liked. But they never lit my cigarette with it. After I'd been sober a short period of time, I then took up smoking cigars and later a pipe. I wore motorcycle chains on my wrists and ankles when I went to meetings. I mean, everywhere. I wasn't, you know. And I had a motorcycle jacket that I got after I'd been sober that said on the back, "Do unto others and then split." Kind of one of those little AA slogans that never really caught on. You know, like, easy does it, think, you know, do unto others and then split. Just, you know, they never put it up in any clubhouse walls. But anyway, I want you to know that if you choose to dress the way that I did, to talk the way that I did, and to treat people the way that I did, that you too can sit in a meeting, not quite this large, but relatively large, and have an entire row all to yourself. There are a whole lot of people that aren't going to want to sit next to you, and I don't blame them a bit, you know. And yet there were still people who tolerated me as I was. You know, I found a sponsor in the early couple of months that I was sober. Seemed like, you know, I was going to 21 meetings a week, and I did that for the first 2 years that I was sober. And it wasn't like, you know, I wanted to get a gold star in AA. I just didn't have any place else to go. You know, I mean, there just wasn't any other opportunities. So I was going to 4 and 5 meetings a day. Most of the time I was either on my way to a meeting, on my way from a meeting, setting up a meeting, tearing down a meeting, and that was just kind of how I did it. And that was how I got through. And I really didn't know if AA was going to be able to work for me. Because even though physically I was not in as bad a shape as a lot of people that I saw coming in then or as I've seen come in since, mentally I could, you know, kind of hold up with the best of them. You know, I mean, I had a lot of mental damage. They used to make me the greeter at the Tuesday night Westwood meeting. I still love that. You have to kind of know this meeting to really appreciate it. But anyway, I would stand there and at the door with barefoot with my motorcycle jacket and cigars welcoming the newcomers as they came to AA. And I'd say, "Hi, I'm June," and someone'd say, "Hi, I'm Kathy," and then they'd walk by and someone else would walk up and she'd say, "Hi, I'm Lynn," and I'd say, "Hi, I'm Kathy," because by then I'd heard so many names I couldn't remember which one was mine, you know. Sometimes as they'd walk by, I'd hear their sponsor whisper, "You see, if you keep drinking, you can end up like that." Because I was standing there, I still had my, you know, my black eye, my swollen lip, you know, a little scabs running down my face, and I just looked great. I hadn't had my flea baths yet. Anyway, And, you know, and I would try and read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I would read the same sentence over and over and over. And I could not remember from the first word to the last word. And I just, you know, I didn't think my mind was ever going to come back like that. I didn't think I'd ever be able to concentrate. And I had once done a lot of reading, you know, but I wasn't able to do it anymore. And I wasn't able to carry on conversations very well with people in Alcoholics Anonymous, which is something very hard to believe for those of you who know me today. But, you know, I really wasn't able to do it. And I'd be standing there and somebody would be talking to me, and all of a sudden I'd say, "Bird." You know, and that made a lot of people nervous. They didn't like to sit next to me. The first 6 or 9 months that I was sober, I heard music all the time, and that was when the radio was not on. I didn't have a radio. And I just heard all the parts. You know, I heard the background music, and I heard the harmony, and I heard the words, and I heard just everything. And I never told anybody in AA that, because I thought they'd lock me up in a mental institution, you know, until I was in a meeting, and this woman got up and took a 9-month chip and said that she'd heard music the first 6 months she was sober. I said, "My God, I should have talked about this. We've been listening probably to the same station, you know." But, and going to these 21 meetings a week, I used to hear a woman named Gail Wilson talk at about 18 of those meetings every single week. I could not get away from her. You know, I mean, geez, I mean, don't they have any other speakers around here? That's why I thought they were being paid, you know. So I thought to myself, you know, I'd heard about this sponsor thing, and I thought, you know, really, as I've already told you my opinion of women generally, but I thought, well, maybe if I ask this woman to be my sponsor, I can find out where she's speaking ahead of time, and then I won't have to go hear her, you know. I can go to other meetings. I mean, there's hundreds of meetings in L.A., and I just kept hearing her over and over and over. So I asked this woman to be my sponsor, and she said yes, because I know that she was taught to never say no to an AA request, because as you can well imagine, I was not baby of the year of 72, you know. And Gail and I were very different. I mean, you know, those people, there's a few here who knew Gail. We were very different. Gail was, she was almost 3 times my age. She'd come from the South, which I automatically, you know, and she wore pink in public. She not only did not use the same language that I used, she didn't know what half the words I was using meant. You know what I mean? It was just terrible. I'd go to the Brentwood meeting and I'd see Gail and I'd go up and I'd say, "Hi, Gail." She'd say, "Hi, June." She'd say, "June, don't sit next to me at the meeting." Said, "I can't take the cigar smoke." And I said, "Okay." And I'd turn to leave and I'd be walking away and she'd say, "And June, please don't tell anyone that I am your sponsor." And that was fine with me because I didn't want people to know I was hanging out with someone lame like Gail, you know. And so we would meet secretly after meetings and talk about the program. At this same time, I found a guy who became my sponsor, and he was much more... he came from the same type of background that I had come from, unlike Gail, and he was more hostile, you know, than I was. I was one of those people, I mean, as you can well imagine, I didn't do a lot of physical damage out there to people, generally speaking, so I had worked very hard at being able to destroy people verbally, and I was pretty good at it, you know. I thought, you know, and so did some other people that, you know, would stay away, and that's why a lot of people in AA stayed away from me. But anyway, I thought I was very good at it, but when I met my sponsor, Jeff, it was kind of like a shark and a goldfish. You know what I mean? I'd try and, you know, cut him down verbally. And it, you know what that's like. If you've ever tried to do that with your sponsor, you can just well imagine what it's like. But anyway, and Jeff would just grab me around the neck and he would threaten to kill me. And now, I've never found that line in the big book where it says, now the sponsor should grab the baby around the neck and threaten to kill him. But it always managed to get my attention, you know. And then he'd tell me what the next meeting would be that I'd be going to. And I remember, you know, the most important thing they'd say at the Monday Night Events Group is you got to get the big book. That's the most important thing you can do if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous. You got to get the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And thought about this, and then at the Monday Night Events Group, they'd say, okay, we sell that book for exactly what we paid for it, and if you don't have enough money, don't worry about it. We'll make liberal credit arrangements, including nothing down and nothing a week. You got to take that book home. And then they'd say at Venice, which is a little bit different kind of a place anyway, they'd say, and if you're too, you know, too afraid to talk to somebody or you don't want to talk to somebody about it, you can just go ahead and steal it. Well, I'd been stealing longer than I'd been drinking. And I saw no reason to stop stealing because I was stopping drinking. They were unrelated activities, as far as I was concerned, and I didn't. I kept stealing for a while after I got sober, but I sort of thought, you know, if I stole this big book from an AA meeting, it would jinx my sobriety. And so instead I went down to the library in Santa Monica and I stole the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. While I was there, I stole a copy of the 12 and 12. No sense making 2 trips, you know. I didn't have a car. It was very inconvenient. Anyway, and I remember I went home and I called Jeff that night and I said, "Hi, Jeff, it's June. I stole the big book today." And And I thought about this, you know, years later when I was giving Jeff a 15-year cake. You know, Jeff didn't say to me that day, he didn't say, "You know, June, we no longer steal now that we're sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous." I remember he said, "That's great! You got the book, you know." Because he knew if it was important enough for me to steal, I was starting to get, you know, serious about sobriety. So, anyway. I have a seventh grade education, and I never went back to high school or junior high after I got sober. I just went to 21 meetings a week, and I got the kind of jobs that you can get with seventh grade education. My sponsors were very practical people. They wanted me to go back to school. They encouraged me to go back, and I wouldn't, you know. And so they said, "Fine, then you're going to get jobs that people with seventh grade educations get," and that's exactly what I did, and I worked, and it was wonderful. It was great for me. The work part wasn't wonderful, but I mean, it was great in the sense that I got the kind of jobs where I could work very flexible schedules so that I could get to 21 meetings a week during those first couple of years. And I became very active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have stayed active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous throughout the years that I've been sober, and I highly recommend it. There's just nothing like it, you know. I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous to show up when I made a commitment. And I was a person that was irresponsible in every area of my life. No one ever could count on me for anything. By the time I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, I had never gone to school 5 days a week and made it all 5 days through all the hours that you were supposed to go. Never. I was always late, you know, or left early, or didn't go, or, you know, got sick, or played sick, or whatever. But I never showed up 5 days in a row, you know, for something that was scheduled. And nobody could count on me for anything. And when I got sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I continued to live, sort of like Bob was saying, you know, about different things. I continued to be an irresponsible flake in every area of my life after sobriety, with the one exception of AA commitments. And I was just, I mean, I just didn't think you could do anything else, you know. I mean, when I was new, I heard someone say, you know, that you had to go to a meeting every day, and I thought they checked, you know. I mean, I didn't even question it. When I was 5 months sober, I started to have these big lumps behind my ears, and they really hurt. And so I went to my home group. I wouldn't have thought of going to a doctor. I went to my home group, and I asked some of the old-timers, you know, and they passed me around, and said, "Oh, come over here, Sam, feel this. What do you think that is?" You know. And they looked, and they said, "You got swollen glands." I thought, okay. So, but then after a couple of days, this other guy that was one of the old-timers in my group said he was going to take me to a doctor, and he took me to a doctor, and I went in, and the doctor felt these lumps by my ears, and he said, "You've got the mumps." And I said, "I do not. I'm not going to believe some doctor over my home group. You know, I have swollen glands." And he said, "No, you have the mumps, and they're very contagious. Have you been around many people?" So I'm going to 21 meetings a week, you know. So he said, "Well, you better let people know that you've exposed them to this, because it can be very, you know, a very dangerous disease." So I went home, and I got out my list from my home group, and I called the first guy. I called up Keith, and I said, "Keith, this is June from Monday Night Venice, and I've exposed you to the mumps." And he said, "That's okay, kid. You can't keep it unless you give it away." And I didn't miss one meeting. Went to 21 meetings a week with the mumps, you know.